Okay, I think we're going to go slightly out of order so we can resolve the AV situation. So the next speaker that we have will be Felicia Roseux, and she also is a Georgetown PhD of GEMS. She has a PhD in early modern European history. She's she's currently at Leiden University, right? And she has several publications, among them Free from Obedience, Constitutional Expressions and the Right of Resistance in Early Modern Transylvania and Poland-Lithuania. So her talk today is The Politics of This and That, Republican Practices Before the Birth of the State in East Central Europe, 14th to the 17th Centuries.
Hello, everyone. I'm so happy to be here, but there is no time for formalities, so I'm just going to jump right into it. And as a matter of fact, my title is a little bit misleading. I'm not going to have time to talk about the birth of the state. We've talked about that on Thursday enough. So my way of honoring Jim today is to offer a few reflections that expand on the idea introduced by him in 95 and in 2003, namely that early modern societies were societies of contradictions, where the reality of this and that at the same time was more pervasive than the utopian belief in this or that. Okay, now that sounds a little bit perhaps obscure. I'll just show you what I understood from this. And I'll do so by briefly touching upon two aspects of politics and the law in early modern Europe, and with some references to the early United States as well, but with a special focus on the elective monarchies of Transylvania and the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, because that's what I know best. And I'm doing so in order to illustrate how comfortable early modern societies, and especially Central European societies, were with what we nowadays would perceive as contradictions. Only two aspects will be mentioned here. First one is the popularity of the mixed regime or the mixed form of government, and second, the issue of shared sovereignty. Okay, first, there's probably no need to remind you that, but I think it's useful, nevertheless, to remind you that before the 17th century, there was a set of political notions that were commonly shared in Latin-educated Europe. Most European societies, not all, but most, were still polities of estates, or Renaissance monarchies, if you will, where authority was divided between rulers and estates. Neither the Italian dichotomy between monarchy and republic, nor Baudin's objections to divided sovereignty were synonymous, had yet become mainstream elements of political thought. Mixed form of governments were synonymous to the concept of republic. And they were considered not just common, but desirable. The term republic was used to denote all political communities, with an exception here. It had a positive connotation. A republic was not just any political entity, but a well-ordered one that was centered on the common good. Its opposite was tyranny, not monarchy. Following Polybius, Cicero, and the Spartan and Roman models, the ideal republic was not depicted as a pure form of government, but as a mixture of monarchic, aristocratic, and popular government under the rule of law. Polish authors described Poland as a Respublika Mixta even before its rather radical reform of its elective system in the 1570s. To them, their polity was one in which king, senate, and the lower nobility, taken to represent the people, governed in the name of the body politic. Stanisław Orzechowski wrote in 1566 that our republic cannot be properly called a monarchy, a democracy, or an oligarchy, but a polity. And that is because this word, polity, does not fit any kind of republic, but only that in which the law commands everything. And just as an aside here, Jean-Jacques Rousseau wrote almost exactly the same thing at the end of the 18th century. He said, every legitimate government is republican. Now, back to the 16th century, outsiders really very quickly adopted that point of view of the Polish Republic being a mixed republic. In 1573, Henry Valois, the first elected king of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, was instructed by his advisors that this realm is a république mêlée of king, optimates, or aristocrats, and popular government. The mixed regime label was pretty much uncontested by the end of the 17th century, and here I'm quoting from an Irish writer. Thus, the Polish gentry, from a kind of monarchical government, have in time made a perfect republic, consisting of three orders, the king, senate, and gentry, which they call the nobility. In mid-17th century, the English theorist James Harrington still maintained that a well-regulated mixed government was the optimal solution to political problems, considering that, and here I quote, there is no such thing as pure monarchy, democracy, or aristocracy. This model remained popular through the 18th century, and it can be argued that it eventually became enshrined in the American model, with the monarch being replaced by the president. Going back to the 16th century, the vision of the mixed regime, of this and that at the same time, was so pervasive that even a devoted proponent of indivisible sovereignty, such as Baudin, believed that royal power should be regulated by the principles of natural law. And even more significantly, he strongly supported the regular convocation of the estates and insisted that to destroy all corporations and communities is to ruin a state and turn it into a barbarous tyranny. Which brings me to my second point on shared sovereignty and the paradox of a powerful king who is not a king. Now, if in Baudin's France, a tyranny was to be avoided only by the moral constraints of a virtuous king, in Poland, Lithuania, and Transylvania, in elective monarchies in general, the same goal was sought by means of electoral conditions. And in these places, electoral conditions were coupled with the right of disobedience, which all elective rulers had to accept and confirm both before and after their coronation. The act of election in and of itself did not limit ruling power. As Baudin himself acknowledged, a king was a king whether he was elected or hereditary. But what made him dependent on the other members of the body politic were the conditions he accepted in exchange for his election, of which the right of disobedience was the most disabling. Simply put, the position of the Polish, Lithuanian, and Transylvania rulers was conditional. But that should not obscure the fact that they remained quintessential members of their republics. Estate resolutions passed during Polish-Lithuanian interregna, for instance, did not become law unless they were confirmed by the next elected king. Moreover, elected rulers had extensive executive powers. The papal nuncio to Poland-Lithuania wrote in 1575 that here a prudent and courageous king does whatever he wants. He went on to say that everybody depended on him as he distributed royal offices, decided capital punishments, and controlled the agenda in the Senate and the Parliament. Now, the nuncio was here a little bit optimistic about the extent of the power of the Polish-Lithuanian king, as later kings found out when they tried to overstep their boundaries. But he did have a point, he did have grounds to make such a point. Because once elected, and as long as he remained within the constitutional framework of the Commonwealth, or in Transylvania's case, within the electoral conditions so that they imposed on their rulers, the king or the princes, the Transylvanian prince's power was so great, and it was, that the estates were rightly anxious to ensure that he used it well. The goal, however, was not to weaken his power, but to prevent the abuse of it. And I would say here, in order to make this principle perhaps more familiar, that the same principle guided the founders of the American Republic in the second half of the 18th century. They sought a strong executive that could be controlled through several mechanisms, election being the most important of them. But as in Poland and Lithuania, the goal was not to weaken the president, but rather to check the possibility of his abusing his power. The difference between an elective monarchy, like Poland, Lithuania, or Transylvania, and the elective republic of the Americans was perceived as one of degree, and sometimes even just nomenclature. A repeatedly re-elected president was essentially an elected monarch, Thomas Jefferson and others pointed out. Conversely, the proponents from the other camp who were advocating electing the American executive for life, such as Alexander Hamilton, right, they thought that the elected kings were harmless because they were little more than presidents. For them, the term monarchy did not even apply to an elective system that included a mechanism of impeachment. And this is something that Baudin also noticed in 1586 and also earlier in the first edition of 1576. He noticed that the disobedience clause of the Henrician Articles, which were the electoral conditions of the Polish-Lithuanian kings, turned the Polish-Lithuanian ruler into a mere prince. What does that mean? Baudin defines principality as nothing other than an aristocracy or a democracy with one person as president or premier, who depends on those who hold the sovereignty, and that is the estates. And so that's how you can have a king who is both very powerful and accountable. A seeming paradox that was able to remain politically functional as long as he was subject to the disobedience clause in Transylvanian or Polish-Lithuanian terms, or to punishment, as Baudin called it, or impeachment in American terms. To conclude, the fact that Poland-Lithuania's first elected king was French, and therefore coming from a political culture that was beginning to distance itself from the late medieval version of shared sovereignty, is illustrated by the ways in which Henri Valois addressed his Polish-Lithuanian electors before and after his coronation. His public statements were peppered with references to love as the fundamental bond between king and subjects. By contrast, the speeches of his successor, Stephen Bathory, who had been ruler of Transylvania for 4 years before he was elected to the Polish-Lithuanian throne, betrayed a vision of kingship that was essentially contractual. Now, don't get me wrong, Bathory was by no means uninterested in violating the constitutional boundaries of his power. He was very interested in that. But his experience in Transylvania had taught him a political language and a political sensibility that was essentially the same as that present in Poland-Lithuania. And he did regard the Polish nobility as bothersome and annoying and disrespectful and an obstacle to his governing vision. But he was also acutely aware that, besides subjects, there were also citizens. Thank you. Mm-hmm.